You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to Strange Familiars. You know the question, Allison.
Yeah, I'm doing well.
Yeah. You know the question.
I know the question.
I don't have to ask it anymore. Hope everybody out there is doing well.
Hey, Tim.
Yeah.
What's the secret of comedy? Timing.
That's a nod to an old friend of ours, Jeff.
I don't know if it was his favorite joke, but he certainly told it over and over and over again to the point where I associate that joke with him.
Yeah. In the time we spent together with Jeff, he lived down the street from us when we lived in Glen Rock, Pennsylvania. And we spent a lot of time. He'd come over two or three nights a week and hang out. We'd play games or we watched The Simpsons a lot, I remember. Yeah. Those good memories of Jeff. And yes, that was one of his favorite jokes.
Not that I'm not sad and I am kind of like,
yeah,
trying to get through this, but at the same time, like, he was a hilarious person who really brought a lot of, he would hate if I said light, and I kind of hate saying light, but he did, or maybe levity.
Yeah, he was a good guy.
Yeah, we'll miss Jeff.
Yeah, so Jeff,
this episode is dedicated to Jeff.
Don't even know if he listened, but
some of his friends might, so
yeah,
we're thinking of all of them too.
Got some other folks in the Strange Familiars family that are going through some health issues right now. So I want to tell them we're thinking about them.
You know who you are.
On tonight's episode, I will be talking to Maxim W. Furyk, author of Shepton, The Myth, Miracle, and Music. If you don't know this story, it's about a mining disaster. Cue the Bee Gees, Allison.
I know. Does it take place in New York?
No, it's Pennsylvania.
Oh, because if we had the rights to New York Mining Disaster, I really would have liked to play that.
Sure.
One of my favorite songs.
Yeah, I love that song too. But this was in
Hometown?
Pennsylvania. Yeah, not too far from...
Centralia?
From Centralia, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
I think Maxim said like 20 miles from Centralia. It's a harrowing story. These guys get trapped in this mine for, I think, 2 weeks.
Does it end well, or you don't want to say yet?
It ends well for two of them.
Okay.
You have this story of men getting trapped in the mine and getting rescued.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing story by itself, but then there's all this weird kind of paranormal stuff that fits into it. They saw entities down there.
I wanted to ask you, like, how different from a sensory, what are they called? deprivation tank. How different is a sensory deprivation tank from being trapped in a mine? I mean, beyond like the panic and the...
Yeah, well, you know, certainly when psychologists look at this and stuff, there's different takes on it, whether they really experience this stuff or not. Both of those miners insist, like completely insisted, that we weren't hallucinating, this happened. If they were hallucinating, most of what they were hallucinating was shared hallucinations. They agreed on what they saw.
Wow.
Including a pretty amazing apparition that appeared down there. So we're going to talk to Maxman in a bit. Before we talk to him, let's just thank our patrons. Thank you, patrons. Thank you so much for your help. We could not do Strange Familiars without you. At this point, we really couldn't make the podcast without our patrons. So you guys mean everything to us. You're the reason why Strange Familiars exists. If you'd like to help us continue to make Strange Familiars and get extra content besides, you can become a patron at Patreon. It's patreon.com/strangefamiliars. There's different tiers of support there. All of our tiers, no matter what, get commercial-free episodes of the weekly shows, plus 2 full exclusive episodes of Strange Familiars every month, just for our patrons. Go ahead to patreon.com/strangefamiliars and check out the different options there. All right, let's go ahead and talk with Maxim. I'd like to welcome Maxim Furyk to the show. How are you doing tonight, Maxim?
Really good, Tim, and thank you so much for this opportunity to address your audience and to talk about the Shepton mining disaster. I'm really excited to be able to have this conversation with you tonight.
Well, I was telling you earlier, I didn't know that I was going to have time to read this before we talk. I'd like to read the books before I talk to any authors, but sometimes I really don't have time. But I sat down with it today. I thought, well, I'll read a little bit of it. And I just sat there and read the whole thing, cover to cover. It is such an amazing story, and I'm excited for the listeners to get to hear a little bit about the story. But before we do that, let's hear a little bit about you. Did you start out as a rock journalist?
Right, yeah, and when people ask me, what does that mean? I'm a rock journalist. I take a look at the culture of rock and roll, I would say through a sociological lens, you know, try to make some sense of it, to validate it. Because, you know, I feel that music has always been important, has been transcendent for us, you know, with certainly with civil rights and the Vietnam movement and just so many other movements. So, you know, you could equate to music. So I wrote a book about the Jordan Brothers. They were a legendary band from Frackville, Pennsylvania. That was really successful. And I wrote a book on Generation X, the demographic that was born between 1965 and 1978.
That's
again,
me.
That had a whole lot of, that had a lot of music, and especially grunge music from the Pacific Northwest, you know, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, mm-hmm. you know, all those groups. And there tended to be a difference in Gen X than there was with my group, the Baby Boomers. And there seemed to be a bit of despondency with Gen X. And it was different because, you know, baby boomers had pretty much intact family structures, dads who worked, mom that stayed home and nurtured us, you know, and this empowerment. There were a lot of us, and there was all this empowerment, this feeling that we were going to help to make the world a better place. I mean, a lot of us believe that. With Gen X, you didn't have that. You had some pessimism. You had new demographic groups, latchkey kids raising themselves because mom and dad were out, you know, trying to survive and work and make a buck. You or were divorced, you know, single parents mm-hmm. raising kids. And you also had another interesting demographic group, and that was grandparents raising kids. And that was because the parents were incarcerated or, you know, addicted to drugs. And we had that. So when I was working on my current book that was just published in 2021, but Somebody Else's Dream, Dakota, the Boys, and Timothy. And I was just writing a book that was going to be a rock mythology about the song Timothy. And Timothy was banned by major radio stations because of inappropriate content. And that was specifically cannibalism. So the song Timothy, that was about cannibalism in a mine shaft, many people felt was about that, felt that it directly paralleled what happened in 1963 in Shepton. So I started to write this story, connecting the dots. But what happened was another story unfolded, and I realized that these miners saw things down there. you know, humanoid creatures, you know, apparitions, golden cities, a whole lot of things. And the story was a lot bigger than what I had anticipated, what I was researching. And that led to my 2016 book, Shepton, the Myth, Miracle, and Music, and this is into tonight's interview. So it was just amazing how those doors opened for me unexpectedly. I went looking for something, but I found something different. So, you know, pretty amazing.
I'm glad you documented this story of the mine. It's so incredible. You could take all the supernatural stuff out of the story and still have a fantastic story. And you add the supernatural stuff in, and it, you know, it's just layers and layers of stuff that happened around this. Can we just kind of lay out what happened at Shepton, just the basics?
Sure. In 1963, three guys were working at Oneida, Pennsylvania. They were working at the number 2 slope, and there was a cave-in. And they were trapped for 2 weeks. It became an international story, and they never found the third guy. And there were allegations of cannibalism. So the thing became bizarre immediately. The news reporters called it the Shepton disaster when actually it was taking place in Oneida. So that was the first thing that was just very weird, you know, mm-hmm. this high strangeness of Shepton. So that was the first thing. But the allegations of cannibalism and then all the other things. So there were just a whole lot of things that happened almost at the same time at this disaster. It was pretty bizarre. It was just unique, not for the number of people that died, but just for all of the strangeness that surrounded it. And still we're trying to figure out, you know, trying to name things, trying to put them into slots mm-hmm. and figure out what exactly happened.
They're working it was essentially an independent mine operation. In fact, one of the guys who was trapped was one of the owners of the mine, wasn't he?
Well, no, Louis Bovey was one of the workers there. He was the one who they never found. But Dave Fallon and Hank Throne were the workers. They were the ones who were rescued. And Hank Fallon, Dave Fallon, rather, was 58 years old. He was a part owner of this independent mine. Mm-hmm. What they would do is after the mining companies had mined out the mining operation, a lot of these independent miners would go in there and they would work in the back and they would rob the pillars. Now the pillars were these pillars of coal that held up the structure, but they would start in the back and take out those pillars and then go to the next one. So, you know, doing it carefully, safely, so that they could get out, you know, without a cave-in. The experts believe that what happened at Shepton was that they were robbing those pillars, and they paid the price. There was a massive mine cave-in, and it happened immediately in the morning of August of 1963. They loaded a bucket of coal, they sent it to the top, and then they tipped it, and they were sending the empty cart back to be filled. And that's when the mine cave-in started. Just a mountain of stone and rock and coal came down on the miners. They were trapped 330 feet underground.
Wow. That's a nightmare. That is just a nightmare. And there's various estimates on the size of the chamber they were trapped in, but it was not big at all.
No. A lot of the places they had to crawl on hands and knees like a dog, and then other places they could actually stand up. But the size of the area was estimated to be maybe as big as a football field, but in varying sizes. You know, again, some places they had to crawl and other places they were able to walk, but it was pitch black and they were sucking in the coal dust. It was in the 50s. There's a constant 50-some degree temperature down there, damp. And then they kept on having the rushes. These are additional mine falls, additional cave-ins that kept on happening. So the whole configuration of that area that they were in kept on changing. It wasn't the same thing. So it was horrific. They were traumatized. I can't imagine what they experienced. But when I wrote Shepton, the Shepton mythology, I tried to write it through a psychological lens. You know, what would it feel like to be down there with no hope of being rescued, no optimism, just the dread that you're down there trapped, you know, and with horrific conditions. And, you know, and a lot of us, I think for a lot of us, claustrophobia is probably one of the most challenging things that a human being has to deal with.
Sure.
And that's what they had down there. It was amazing that they were able to survive on so many levels. you know, that's that in itself is, I think, is a miracle.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, what a story! And their lights went out. What was it, like 30 minutes after the collapse?
Yeah, one by one, and then even their wristwatches that would illuminate in the dark, even that started to go out too. So at some point, they had nothing; just it was pitch black.
Before they were rescued, how many days did they spend underground?
Yeah, they were down there for something like 2 weeks.
Oh my goodness!
Before they were rescued, you know. And again, the world, this was international news. There were newspaper reporters, journalists from the United Kingdom and Germany and Japan, and they were watching this. And this was a story that had international appeal. And I've written numerous times that there was a sort of a preface to the book. And if I could, the August 13th, 1963 Shepton mining disaster has been called a continuous collective hallucination, an out-of-body experience, a miracle by Pope John the 23rd, and proof of life after death. Fate magazine described Shepton as unmatched in the annals of psychic research, and the Associated Press listed Shepton as one of the year's most significant news stories. Now, that was 1963, and the only news story that surpassed Shepton was later on in November of 63, and that's when our President John Kennedy was assassinated. And that was another tragedy. Mm-hmm. There's a correlation between Kennedy and the Shepton narrative, too, that is really interesting that I think a lot of people don't know about.
All right. Do you want to give it away? Or is it?
I would like to. First of all, I think if you're a Roman Catholic, you're probably aware of Pope John the 23rd and his miracles and Vatican II and a lot of the things that he did. And that's fine. But I go around and do these presentations, and there's a lot of people that don't know of him, and they don't know anything about Roman Catholicism. But the one thing I point out is Pope John the 23rd was there in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that is when we came very close to either a nuclear incident or World War III.
Sure.
I mean, we came very close. Mm-hmm. Now, the players there were President John Kennedy, Fidel Castro of Cuba, and Nikita Khrushchev of the Soviet Union. Pope John the 23rd, one of the things that he did was he wanted to have a rapport. He wanted to have relations with the communist and the Marxist. And he believed that there needed to be a dialogue. So by articulating that, he gained the respect of, you know, the communists in the Soviet Union and in Cuba. So during this crisis, Pope John the 23rd, it is believed and it's documented that he was able to go and have audience with Castro and Khrushchev to have them toned down, and also with President Kennedy. So we don't know exactly what happened behind closed doors. There was probably some sort of a deal that was made that the Soviet Union agreed to back down, to not have missiles there in Cuba. And I don't know what we gave up. I mean, I've read about this extensively, but I'm sure that there was something that, you know, that we don't know about. But Pope John the 23rd was instrumental in that. So he becomes larger than life when you take a look at his life experience. The other thing, liberal Catholics really loved Pope John the 23rd. They call him the good pope because he was liberal, because he brought about Vatican II. And Vatican II was an attempt to modernize the church and bring it into the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And he did that by doing things like, giving more respect to women, to other religions, people that are Jews and Muslims. And also with Vatican II, he allowed Mass to be said in languages other than Latin.
Right.
And for liberal Catholics, this was just a wonderful progressive thing. But for the traditionalists, I mean, they disliked him. They hated what he did. And so, you know, Pope John the 23rd, I mean, you know, on the one hand, he's, you know, just a wonderful, you know, innovator and forward thinker. But a lot, there was plenty of people, too, that didn't like what he did. And also, to this day, there are, you know, Catholics that refuse to go along with Vatican II.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's controversial as well as progressive.
We'll talk about how he works into the mine disaster. It was a very, very interesting part of the story.
Absolutely, yeah.
As we go on. So, did you grow up in Pennsylvania?
Yes, I'm originally from Berwick, Pennsylvania. That's in Columbia County. And that's about I would say about 30, maybe 45 minutes from Shepton. You know, Shepton is just outside of Hazleton. So we knew of this. You know, we, you know, I was just a kid at the time. I was in high school. I think it was 16 when that happened. And it was a big story. Some of my friends went over there. I never did. But during this Shepton drama, there were a couple of thousand people there, a National Guard, Salvation Army, military, state troopers, just tons of people, tons of cameramen. You know, this was a big media event. There were also some interesting people, like people that portrayed themselves as doctors. They were there handing out protein bars and things. This is back in 63. And they were not doctors. They were, I don't know, they were just like sort of con artists, that, you know, trying to, I don't know, work the crowds. But, you know, there was a lot of things happening there. There were military people who were experts in the bomb shelters. You know, how long could a person survive in a bomb shelter? But, you know, being in a bomb shelter with food and supplies and a bunk and, you know, and maybe some kind of some level of warmth and comfort is different than being trapped in a mine 330 feet below, you know, in 50 some degree temperatures with dampness and, you know, and coal dust and all that. So they were monitoring these guys and taking notes. So in a sense, the Shepton miners that were trapped were sort of like guinea pigs. I mean, they were being watched and their movements were being, you know, documented and, you know, sort of scientifically. So it's kind of interesting, the number of different diverse groups that were there at that Shepton disaster site.
After so many days of them being trapped, a lot of people had given up hope on them being alive, but it was Fallon's brother, right, who insisted that they try to rescue him.
Right, and they were estranged, and maybe this was a way for the brother to go and bring it full circle and atone or whatever. I mean, who knows? But typically in mine disasters, what they would do is they would, you know, it was just difficult to go down there. It was expensive to try to rescue the miners, you know, the trapped miners, and also it was dangerous. Typically, they would just bulldoze that mining site and maybe put a concrete pad on it. And the Catholic priest would come, you know, the majority of them were Catholics, the miners, and the priest would give the last rites of absolution. So the mining site, the disaster site, would just become a tribute, a memorial to the miners. But in this case, Fallon's brother, you know, sort of demanded that they go and make it a rescue operation. And after talking to some of the people, they decided that they would do that. And they couldn't go down the borehole because that was just filled with rock and debris and timbers. So they had to find another way to get down to the miners. They felt if they went down through the borehole, that would take them just too many days and the miners would die. So the plan was to go and go through the side and do a slant borehole to try to find them. And they thought, well, if they're going to be any place, they're going to be here. And so that was what the plan was. The plan was to go and rescue the miners. There was no money in the coffers of the Shepton Oneida mine number two. And that was Davy Fallon's independent mine. So they had to get monies from the state. And I believe, it's in my book, but I think it was like the number was $60,000 that the state needed to kick in to get this thing started or completed. But anyway, they did. And it led to just a miraculous rescue attempt and an innovative technique, too.
It was Fallon's brother who told him where to drill.
They thought that if they were going to be any place, they would be in a monkey shaft. And the monkey shaft was a little place where they would keep food and water and tools. And they thought that during the cave-in that possibly the miners would jumped into the monkey shaft. And if they were still alive, that's where they would be. So that's where they shot for. What happened was they had a drill. And this is, I mean, there's a number of things. I mean, they're just bizarre. They're peculiar. I mean, you could put a name for it, but I think they're all like little miracles, you know, in this huge Shepton miracle. They had a drill, and the drilling rig was going towards the site that they identified to drill to get to the monkey shaft. And the drill broke down before they got to that site. And it was quite a ways away. So they decided to dig down anyway. And they were able to go and reach the miners through that. Now, that was just a bizarre occurrence. It never should have happened like that, but it did. So that's another part of this Shepton mythology that just defies any kind of logic or anything, you know. But
so they get a little hole drilled down to them. What was it, 6 inches or something, that they could get them food and water, which, by the way, they had been drinking, sulfur water from the mine?
Sulfur water, there was sulfur water there. They were eating on timber, you know, just to fill their stomach. But I believe, I mean, it's that during the first several days that they were traumatized. Mm-hmm. They were shocked that they were not hungry. They might have been thirsty, but they just weren't hungry. I mean, I think that was the furthest thing from the mind. I just think that they were just in total turmoil and distress and, you know, trying to find their center and trying to do what they could to, you know, get through this ordeal. Mm-hmm. Fallon, being the older guy, he knew that they were 330 feet down, and he sort of estimated when they would be able to go and rescue him. And one thing that happened after he was rescued, and not to give it away, but yeah, they were the two guys were rescued. Mm-hmm. But he was very critical of the rescue team for not getting them out earlier. So he became the pariah, and he had to walk that back. Because now, the thing about Fallon, Dave Fallon, that he was an old-time miner, he was 58 years old. He had character and spunk. He was like the Coal Region's John Wayne. But he said it like it was. I mean, if something was on his mind, he would say it. And the fact that he thought that they took too long to rescue him was one of the things that he talked about and was angry about, and it came back on him. So he had to sort of apologize for that.
Mm-hmm. So eventually, after they dig this small borehole, which even that must have been an incredible relief to these guys, you know, just some kind of contact with the world, that somebody knows you're down there.
Right. So that borehole, they were able to give them warm liquids, mm-hmm. give them soup, and give them a salve for their hands and you know, the bruises, because they were all cut up from the rock and everything. There were military psychologists that talked to them, try to keep them calm, and you know, give them messages of hope that they were going to be rescued. But you know, the thing of it is, even though there was a borehole, you know, the next couple of steps were very precarious, because mm-hmm. when they were going to drill a bigger borehole, they had to do this in such a way that it wouldn't bring down, you know, that part of the mine shaft and the roof and another cave in. So, you know, all of this stuff is very, you know, delicate and dicey. And, you know, again, you're talking about going through 330 feet of rock and coal. One individual that played a part in this was Howard Hughes, and he was the billionaire from Houston, Texas, and mm-hmm. he was able to fly up several tungsten drill bits by Navy fighter jets, and they flew to the Hazleton Airport. They used those to drill through the rock and coal. So he was one of the heroes of the Shepton mythology.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, which, you know, just not knowing much about mine cave-ins and stuff, I didn't realize how much of a scare this was the fear of the mine filling up with water at any time.
Yeah, all the time, yeah. And that and the rats, you know, there were always rats around, and a lot of times they would feed the rats, because if the rats were around, you know, they knew that there wasn't any additional mine subsidences coming or water. Mm. And the fear of being flooded, like, for example, the Shepton mining rescue technology was used in 2002 and 2010. I just wanted to talk about that briefly. In 2002, there were 9 miners that were trapped at Kew Creek, Pennsylvania. And what happened was they were using outdated maps. They drilled into the wall, and all of this dirty water came in there. 9 miners are trapped, and the water is going up higher and higher and higher. Their heads are above water, and they realized that they had maybe 1 hour left to live. This is in Kew Creek, Pennsylvania, in southwestern PA, south of Pittsburgh. All these guys started to write letters to their loved ones and put them in these bottles, you know, because they thought they were going to die. Yeah. Finally, after the water started to subside, These guys were rescued by the same technique that was developed in Shepton, and that was a capsule that was developed. The same thing, and they were trapped there in QQ for 78 hours. The same thing happened again in 2010, and this was the infamous Chilean copper mine disaster. The 33 men were trapped for 69 days, and again, it was the Shepton mining the rescue technology that saved them. And what they did was, I mean, the original plan at Shepton was to use these bullet-like capsules, and they were going to lower them to the slope's bottom. They were 7.5-foot cylinders, but at Shepton, they realized that the borehole, the Shepton borehole, wasn't smooth, and it was just irregular, and they thought that the if they tried to use that, that the miners would get trapped in the capsule. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to do that. So what they did was they had parachute harnesses, and the miners were greased up, and they brought them, they rescued them with that. But the technology was used in Q Creek in Chile, which, you know, which the one thing that sort of fascinates me and disturbs me is that very few people outside of the coal region realize that the Shepton technology did that. Now, if you were to go to Shepton, you go to Schoolhouse Road, there's a nice plaque that was put up by the Pennsylvania, I guess it was the Historical Commission, and it attributes the Shepton rescue technology to, you know, Q Creek and Chile. But few people outside of our area know that, and I just think that's kind of sad, because this is something that we should champion, and we should, you know, we need to be proud of what the mining technicians did in 63 that was used elsewhere.
So they were able to rescue two of the three. The third miner was never found. Basically, they said that he was on the other side of the mine when it came down, and they heard him for a little bit. Said, you know, he said his leg was broken or something, and then that was that was it.
And that, and I believe that what happened was that there was a mountain of rock and coal that just landed in between them. I really believe that they were separated. Felon and Throne were separated from Bova by this this mountain. Again, I don't know. That's my conjecture.
Right.
But a lot of other people think that there was cannibalism.
Yeah.
And back then in 63, they did. And and even today, there's people that still believe that. So I'm not exactly sure why. But so instead of the story dying in 63, it was resurrected in 1971 when the boys released Timothy. Mm-hmm. And so you have a pop song that eerily seems to parallel what happened in Shepton. So here we go again, you know, for some of those Shepton people that might have been traumatized for what happened or what they thought happened, it's happening again in a pop song. And as it turned out, Timothy was the highest charting rock song, you know, in northeastern and I believe north central Pennsylvania. So it was number 17 on the Billboard charts, and it was huge. And just fueled by that controversy, you know, by the yuck factor, by the censorship, you know, radio stations like WABC that refused to play it because of inappropriate content. So, you know, there you have it. You have a controversial song that the college kids liked, and when people started to listen to it, listen to the lyrics, and they would discuss this. So Timothy was stayed on the charts for quite a while, and you know, it was the biggest thing that the boys from Wilkes-Barre ever experienced. One other thing for your listeners in the area, this thing is coming full circle in March 30th of 2023. The boys who recorded Timothy will be inducted into the Central Pennsylvania Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And that's going to be on March 30th in Hershey, Pennsylvania at the Hershey Theater. And it's just amazing. And another oddity is that the boys are getting recognized not in Luzerne County and Lackawanna County, where they're from, but in the Hershey area. And I'm not sure what county that is, but that's, you know, a ways away from the boys' hometown. But
yeah.
Anyway, I mean, it's wonderful news, and you know, I'm just so gratified that, you know, the boys are being recognized for their musical contribution, and maybe even cultural contribution. You know, I mean, the song just has deep roots, you know, with Shepton and mm-hmm. the coal region.
Did they ever admit that it was about Shepton?
No, that's pretty. Jerry Ludzik, who was from Jeddo, you know, there was a place outside of Hazel called they called it Japan. It was named Japan Jeddo. And then after World War II, they just changed it to Jeddo. But Jerry believed that when Rupert Holmes wrote the song, and Rupert was 19 years old, he was working for Scepter. I think a lot of your listeners know the story, but Scepter Records had given the boys a 2-record deal. Mm-hmm. And the first record that they did was called These Days, and that, it was a nice song, but it bombed. It didn't go anyplace. So Rupert Holmes, who was working for Scepter, he decided to write a song that would be controversial and that would get the boys notoriety. He was hoping that the boys would then get a record contract with another label. That was the plan. So he wrote the song about cannibalism in a mine shaft. It was called Timothy. So the song took off. Unfortunately, the song got the notoriety, not the boys. Mm. I mean, it became their bread and butter, and they traveled extensively with Timothy. And one of their claim to fame that, you know, very few people outside the area know about was the Sapsot Rock Festival. That was in 1971 in Grays Harbor County, Washington. There were 150,000 people there over 4 days. And this was the Pacific Northwest version of Woodstock. So they had mud and rain. They had drugs called stumblers. They were barbiturates that the kids were drinking, taking the stumblers with wine. And there were a lot of overdoses there. But anyway, the boys opened up for Sapsot 2 days in a row. And that was sort of a pretty neat coup that they were able to go and orchestrate that. But anyway, the boys, like I said initially, I was writing a book about the boys and Timothy and the connection to the Shepton Mine disaster. And that was going to be the book, just a rock mythology. But as I investigated and researched Shepton, I found out that Shepton had a lot more variables. There were a lot more levels, mm-hmm. you know, fascinating levels mm-hmm. in Shepton.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Before we leave the cannibalism accusations, which, like you, I don't think they apply. I think it's, you know, it's just to work people up, essentially. Yeah. But there was sort of old miner lore that you talk about in the book where they said when a cave-in would happen, they would just take the smallest guy. And
yeah, a couple of things. The Chicago Daily News said that. They said that mining lore was that they would eat the shortest guy. And in this case, it was Louis Bova. And when Fallon was confronted with that, he told the reporter, he said, only evil men would ask such a question, you mm-hmm. know, about cannibalism. So he mm-hmm. denied it. One thing that's interesting, though, I said that the Shepton mine technology saved those guys, those 33 men in Chile, the Chilean copper mine disaster. Mm-hmm. They were running out of food. They were trapped there for 69 days. They had daily rations, a little bit of tuna fish, a little bit of milk, and a cracker. And they knew that at a certain point, they were going to run out of food. There were several books written about the Chilean copper mine disaster. There was a movie called The 33, so it's been well documented. They wrote in the one book that they talked about cannibalism. If they did run out of food, you know, there was that possibility that maybe they would have to resort to cannibalism just to survive. Wow. There was some dark gallows humor here. All of the guys were from Chile, except the one guy was from Uruguay. And according to the book, they said, if anybody's going to get it, it'll be the guy from Uruguay.
Oh, jeez. Wow.
So that was the gallows humor. But unfortunately, you know, cannibalism is part of the Shepton mythology. And then so is the miracle of Pope John the 23rd. So you have that grotesque with the miraculous. I mean, just like this, just this almost a psychedelic swirl of mm-hmm. things. I initially wanted to call the book The Shepton Convergence because there was a convergence of themes, you know, the cannibalism, the miracle, the technology, the rescue technology, the humanoid creatures, the golden cities, all that. But I didn't think people would understand what convergence meant. Mm-hmm. And so I decided not to call it that. The title that speaks to me is the Shepton Mythology, and that's on the back. But again, I had to go and describe things, and that's why the name of the book is Shepton, The Myth, Miracle, and Music. And I kind of wish that I would have just called it the Shepton Mythology, but I thought I had to explain what it was to the reader. So, but the book has just done so well, and I've just had so many people just thank me for writing this. I was doing a presentation at the Ousterhout Library in Wilkes-Barre, and there was a guy there, an elderly gentleman, and he had a legal pad, and he's taking notes as I'm talking. So during the break, we had a chance to talk, and the guy was from Poland, and he said that when he was a young man, mining companies from Pennsylvania would come over to Poland and try to recruit these young guys to come to work in the coal mines. They would tell these guys that the streets of America were paved in gold. So that was the promise. So, as it turned out, these miners, and so many of them were from Poland and Italy and Slavic countries, and they became more or less indentured servants. I mean, they were working for the man, and, it was just tough to get out of there. You mm-hmm. go to the company store, and you were just indebted to the companies, the mine companies. So it was just a hard life. And then there was the good and the bad. The good was that anthracite coal from northeastern Pennsylvania fueled the Industrial Revolution, and, we're so proud of that. And then after World War II, fewer and fewer young men wanted to work in the mines like their fathers did. It was just too dangerous, and it was just really hard to go and recruit people. So, the mining died out quite a bit after World War II.
How is your book received in the area? Like, so I'm, I'm outside of the coal region in southern Pennsylvania here, and, I'm reading this amazing story, which is new to me, but I imagine it's more known in your area. Is it a taboo subject, I suppose, to talk about, or are people still recovering?
You mean the cannibalism?
The Shepton disaster in general, I mean.
No, it's we've had other, we had the Knox disaster, which has been called the Knox mine murders, but this disaster was when the mine company drilled too close to the river, the Susquehanna River.
Yeah,
the,
you talk about that in the book. It's horrifying.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
It was horrible. Yeah, horrible. Yeah. But this, they call it the Knox mine murders because the company knew that they had to be like 29 feet, I forget what it was, from the river, and they went right through that, and those guys died, and that was a horrific thing. No, I think that a lot of us are celebrating the rich history of the coal region, the coal region being a 100-mile stretch from Scranton down to Harrisburg, and then a 30-mile thing. It was just rich in anthracite coal, and, they had Phoebe Snow, who was this young lady that wore a white dress, and she would ride on the train, to demonstrate that, there's no soot, that she would stay, clean and white, she was the Phoebe Snow. So there were just amazing things that, that happened. There was a Grammy winner. The woman was from Philadelphia, and she did this play, almost like a opera, a musical thing, about the coal region, about the flowers and about the miners and about the breaker boys. And the whole story of the coal region is just so phenomenal. I mean, breaker boys, little boys, kids that had to work. There was a kid that was 5 years old that was the head of the household. His father died. In order to stay in the company home, he had to work, and he would go down there and lead, 5 years old, lead the mule around. That was his job.
Wow.
So you had these kids that were breaker boys that were getting hurt. And the other thing, too, that I believe I have this in my book, but the treatment of children was horrendous in America, and there were rights for animals, legislative rights for animals that were passed, that were enacted before the rights for children. That is just amazing that it played out like that. But the coal region just has so many interesting stories. And what I'm trying to do is, one, I want to document this, and I think the Shep does that. And then the other thing, my new book is called Coal Region Hoodoo, Paranormal Tales from Inside the Pit. And I take Shepton and Centralia and Pope John the 23rd and St. Teresa of Avila and all these other themes in Shepton. I take them a little bit further. And I'm really excited about this book and the possibility to maybe, you know, do another podcast interview with you.
Oh, yeah, you will definitely be coming on for that. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm excited. It's being published by Beyond the Fray.
Friends of ours.
Friends of yours, yes, and I can't thank you enough. It looks like it's going to be out this month. You know, we're waiting for the formatting and everything.
Oh, fantastic. I didn't know it was coming that soon. That's fantastic. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm excited. I mean,
yeah, me too.
So Shepton, like I said, I wanted to call it the convergence because all of those themes. There is one chapter in my book. It's called Extrication. And what I wanted to do, I wanted to go and just read a bit from it, if I may. And this is chapter 10. And it starts off with claustrophobia. And what happened was they took these two miners and they had them go into these parachute harnesses. They were special coveralls that were made out of parachute harnesses. They greased them up with axle grease. And then they pulled them up through the slope. And the circumference of the borehole was only 17 and a half inches wide.
Wow.
So they had to put these gobs of the axle grease on their clothing so that they would go up the narrow structure. They took turns putting the grease on each other. The interesting thing is that Dave Fallon, the older guy, insisted that Throne be rescued first.
Mm-hmm.
He thought this would be easier because Throne was young and he was highly emotional, and Fallon didn't want him to be at the bottom, you know, languishing with his demon. So he wanted Throne to go up first. And they had to put their arms over their heads. They had helmets and they had microphones. So the chapter called Extrication, there's a segment called Claustrophobia. And it goes like this. For some, claustrophobia is a condition considered worse than death. Slithering upwards through the borehole was, in many ways, a severe horror than being entombed in the cavern. Throne was petrified. The thick cable tightened and began to tug him upwards, slowly through the narrow opening. His arms stretched to a point of impossibility, and he feared that his limbs would be torn from their screaming sockets. He felt throbbing, continuous pain. His anterior shoulder and upper arm muscles burned in response to the maneuver. He struggled to slow down his heartbeat, to relax, but was unable to control the creature that snarled inside his chest and threatened to rupture his heart. As he gasped for breath, a dry heave lodged in his parched throat. He began to hyperventilate. His body whipped and twisted pretzel-like in slow motion as he was pulled upward. Throne's heart began to pound, his mind racing as the harness encircled him and slowly spun him around. A violent tug forced him sideways into the wall. The parched skin around his lips blanched in fear. His body shook uncontrollably. Throne tried to maintain control as a choking sense of terror, a dizzying nausea filled him. And then we go on and on. And with Throne, it took 15 minutes and 45 seconds for him to go from the bottom to the top. And it was a torment. When he was lifted to the top, he passed out.
Mm.
Fallon, on the other hand, again, Fallon, the stoic, you know, John Wayne type, he did this in 8 minutes and 15 seconds, almost half the time.
And came out singing.
He came out singing.
Amazing.
She'll come around the mountain when she comes.
Amazing.
Allegedly, they sent him some whiskey. And when they were rescued, two Marine helicopters were parked there. And they took them one by one to the Hazleton State Hospital. President John Kennedy sent a telegram to the survivors, and it said, I'm going to read it here. Congratulations. The stamina, courage, and spirit that you and your rescuers have exhibited in recent days have earned the admiration of all Americans. I wish to join with them in expressing my heartfelt good wishes for your speedy recovery. So that was, you know, we had the connection with John Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Pope John the 23rd. The interesting thing, when the miners went to the Hazleton State Hospital, Throne, who was an atheist, saw the picture of Pope John the 23rd, and Throne goes to Fallon. He goes, look, that's him. That's the stranger. That's the guy we saw down there in the pit.
Right.
Fallon, who was a devout Roman Catholic, he had seen all kinds of pictures of Pope John the 23rd, but not Throne. So he saw that. The other thing that happened, before they went to the top, Fallon said this to Throne. He said, Hank, keep your mouth shut. Don't tell them what we saw down there. Mm. They'll think we're crazy. Mm-hmm. But as soon as Hank Throne, 28 years old, went to the top, and they had all these paparazzi asking him questions. And I mean, it was the same in 63 as it is now in 2023. Hank Throne started to talk about the Pope, you know, seeing the stranger, talk about the humanoid creatures that they saw, the Golden City, the stairwells, and all of this other stuff that, you know, is so much a part of the Shepton mythology. Fallon didn't want him to talk about it. Fallon wanted him to just not talk about it, and mm-hmm. He broke down, and the word was out. An amazing story. It still is.
Yeah. You know, they're down there in the dark, and they see several things. But since we already talked about the Pope, let's start with the Pope. They see the Pope down there with them, you know, an apparition of the Pope, but they said he was there the whole time.
Right. They said he was there the whole time, just standing there, giving them a sign that they were going to be rescued, a sign of peace, a sign to keep them calm. What's interesting, there were two other alleged miracles performed by Pope John the 23rd. Those other two were medical miracles. They took place in Italy. People had, the one nun had stomach cancer, and she saw the image of the Pope. In all three cases, the MO, the modus operandi, was the same. The Pope was there in the corner, just standing there, not doing anything, not touching them, not singing, not speaking, but just his presence was there. And the doctors in Rome believed that this was a medical miracle, what he did there. When Pope John the 23rd was canonized in 2014, Vatican scholars attributed Shepton as one of his miracles. Also, Father Joseph Mary, who is the chaplain for EWTN, Eternal Word Television Network, the Catholic media conglomerate in Alabama. Father Joseph Mary was there in 2014, and he attributed Shepton as one of the miracles, and he spoke about that, you know, extensively. They believe that the Pope was there. Now, again, we ask ourselves, what was this? I mean, was it a miracle? And when I wrote the Shepton book, that was my conclusion, that it was a miracle. Now I'm just wondering, I think it was a miracle, but there may be another name for it. Maybe guardian angel, maybe spirit guide, maybe, holy apparition. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure, but it was something that was good. And, you know, I believe that these miners were blessed and they were meant to be rescued. And the Pope and also the humanoids that they viewed, I believe that was part of that miracle too, that apparition. Again, you know, we see things, you know, in the paranormal, we see things and we try to go and figure out what they are and we try to name to them. But with Pope John the 23rd, it just seems to be a miracle. And again, all three of his miracles happened after he died.
At the point he appears in the mine, he's already passed.
Yeah, he died in June. And
Fallon knew this.
Yeah, Fallon knew this.
But
yeah.
He did not mention it to the other fellow he was trapped
no,
with.
No, Hank Throne was young and he was impetuous and he was highly emotional. Mm-hmm. Fallon wasn't like that. Fallon was a hardcore miner. He'd been mining since he was like 15 years old. So he was just tough. I mean, he was just, what a hero for the coal region. I mean, what a great guy. And
the more
I researched this book, the more I respected him for his grit and his character and his candor and his spirituality. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a religious man. You know, he believed he had a strong faith. I believe that got him through. We talk about in psychology, we talk about symbiosis, where you have maybe a parent and a child. And I think that there was a symbiotic relationship between Fallon and Throne, you know, the older Fallon, the younger Throne. And they, to keep warm, they rubbed each other, you know, to keep the circulation going. They would dig to rescue them, to get themselves out. They would tap to let the rescue team know where they were, and they would pray. So it was tap, dig, pray, tap, dig, pray. They had their own mantra. Mm-hmm. And they believed that they saw the humanoid creatures. They believed that they saw stairways leading to heaven. This is in pitch darkness. And they believe that those stairwells were, that their ancestors and their family members were seated on those stairs.
Yeah, so I definitely want to cover that. I just want to finish up with the Pope because it's so amazing. Felon didn't want him to panic, so he didn't tell him, like, this is the Pope and he's passed away and he's standing here next to us. That's what makes it so amazing when, I'm sorry, I keep forgetting the second guy's name. It's Felon and...
Yeah, Throne.
When Throne gets to the hospital and sees the picture of the Pope and recognizes him, not only did he not know he was a Pope, he didn't know he had passed away.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly,
it's
such
an amazing thing. And for him to say, that's the guy that was down there with us. They both saw him. It wasn't just like the Catholics saw him. They both saw him.
Yeah. And when they were... questioned, when they were interrogated, you know, interviewed separately, both Felon and Throne came up with similar stories, similar descriptions of all of the different aspects of Shepton. So that was pretty amazing.
It was
truly amazing.
You mentioned that as I'm reading this, I'm familiar enough with the story of the Belva mine disaster because of these flannel-clad entities have become quite a character on the podcast. We talk about them a lot. And at some point, someone pointed me to that, say, hey, you got to check out the Belva mine disaster, in which a door, these guys are trapped in the mine. A door in the mine basically opens up in the wall of the mine. This guy dressed like a lumberjack steps out and tells them, don't worry, you're going to be rescued, and walks back through the door. A very similar thing happens with a door in the side of the mine at Shepton.
Right. With the blue light.
Mm-hmm.
John Giger has a thing called the third man theory. And he talks about apparitions. He talks about during times of psychological stress, Arctic explorers, Lindbergh flying across, his transatlantic flight to Paris, the Shepton disaster. Giger believes that there's apparitions that show up to give us courage and faith and strength that we're going to be rescued, that things are going to turn out for us. Mm-hmm. And I believe, and I heard about this after Shepton was published, but the description of what Pope John the 23rd actually is or represents, just expanded a bit with John Giger's theory. So again, it's just another theory, another attempt to find meaning. And that's what we do as human beings. We have a search for meaning. And I love the paranormal realm because that's what this is. I mean, we just try to put our heads together and figure out what exactly this means. And I just think it's so fascinating. And, I'm just so thrilled and grateful to be a part of this, this family, I guess, paranormal family.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. Good people all around.
Yeah.
The door, when it opens in the mind, that's where they see the staircase leading to what seems to be heaven and the Golden City.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And Felon and Throne had already passed. I never had a chance to interview them. Felon, he was 58 at the time of the mining disaster. He died at age 74, and Throne died at age 63. He was 28 during the Shepton disaster. But I had met this gentleman that worked in finance, and he did some work with Davy Felon. And he agreed to be interviewed, but he didn't want me to use his name, so he was anonymous. But he would ask Davy, go, Davy, what about this cannibalism? And Davy said, no, that never happened. That's not true. It's just a horrible thing. And what about the ancestors, family members sitting on the stairwell? And the story is well known because the Associated Press, I believe, might have had exclusive rights to the Shepton story. I think they paid Felon and Throne for maybe a one-year exclusivity for the story.
Mm-hmm.
So the story is well known, but the person from Hazleton that I interviewed, he said that Felon talked about family members and ancestors being on the stairs, and he recognized some of them, but others, although he didn't really recognize them by knowing them, he knew that they were part of his family. So that was just another aspect of the Shepton narrative.
Yeah.
In pitch black. Pitch darkness.
And at some point they start seeing these little short entities with lights, and they said they were crawling towards them, but the closer they got to them, the further they seemed away from them.
Yeah, they went away. They saw that. And then they also saw humanoid creatures. And they both, when they were interviewed, again, separately, they both had the same description. They said that these humanoids were built like football players. They were muscular. They had long black hair, and they had hair bands. They had sort of a tan, bronze complexion, pointed ears. They wore sandals. They looked sort of like Egyptians or Roman soldiers. And both felon and throne had similar descriptions. You know, it was a variation of the theme. But it was just amazing that they were able to go and, you know, have the similar descriptions. When they were interviewed by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, she thought that there was really something profound here, you know, with their story.
She wrote On Death and Dying. She did a lot of psychological studies for near-death experiences and stuff, right?
Right, yeah. She was pretty impressive. She was a Swiss-American psychiatrist. And she pioneered near-death studies. She authored that On Death and Dying, which looked at the five stages of grief,
okay,
which was really profound. I mean, she was named one of the 100 most important thinkers of the 20th century and all that. But with death and dying, you know, a lot of people, when a loved one dies, you know, we express anger, and then we negotiate with God, you know, please, if you bring them back, I'll be good.
Right.
And then finally, we go through a process, and finally... And it takes longer for some of us, but we finally have that acceptance that my loved one has gone. And then you bring your own conclusion to that, you know, whatever that means. You need to have closure with that. But Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did that. Now, what happened was there was a newspaper guy from Shenandoah. His name was Ed Conrad, and he befriended Dave Fallon. He met him at a funeral, befriended him. And what he did was he took Dave Fallon around and he had people interview them. They polygraphed him. They had his narrative notarized. And then what he did was he took him down to Headwater, Virginia to meet Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross believed that what they experienced was profound. She believed that they experienced life after death, and she was talking about specifically about Pope John the 23rd. And then the other thing is she believed that the miners experienced an out-of-body experience. And I talk about that. I talk about St. Teresa of Avila, who was a Spanish mystic, and St. Teresa believed that through prayer and meditation, people could experience states of rapture and ecstasy, and what she called flight of the soul, which was what the out-of-body experience that was experienced by Fallon and Throne. Fallon said that it happened to him twice, happened once to Throne, but they were able to go and have this out-of-body experience where they went out of the mine and looked down and could see the rescue team and all the people, you know, the thousands of people.
Amazing.
Yeah, pretty amazing that this story is not just one of the paranormal, but one of the maybe the spiritual, the miraculous, the, you know, I mean, the technological, the, you know, the grotesque with the cannibalism. I mean, it just seemed to be a lot of variables here.
Yeah. And like I said, I think you take any one of those elements and have a book, you know, have a story at least, but they all come together in your book. I really, really enjoyed it. I told you earlier, like, there are parts of it that I was tearing up, like the emotion of these guys just trapped in that mine. And then you get to the paranormal stuff on top of it. It's such an incredible story. They always insisted, both of them insisted they were not hallucinating these events.
Exactly, yeah. And when I wrote the book, I followed their words, you know, and I believe that. Now, you know, you could say that they were hallucinating, like a dual hallucination, you know, that they both experienced the same thing, or you could say it was a result of drinking the sulfur water, whatever. But I don't believe that. I believe that something happened. There's something profound. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there were, you know, things that we really don't even know to this day. But it's too easy to go and use Occam's theory or Occam's razor and discount the Shepton mythology. But I believe that what happened here is valid, and I think it's significant in the annals of parapsychology and the paranormal. I mean, I think it's profound, and I think there's something else. I'm not exactly sure, time warp, a time continuum, something that caused a convergence of energies, you know, at the same place at the same time. Mm-hmm. Again, what that is, I don't know. I'll leave that to future researchers to label and find out. But the story is, it gets so much bigger in the retelling. And again, I'm looking forward to Co-Region Hoodoo because it takes the Shepton mythology a step further. And also I write extensively about St. Teresa of Avila, who is just such a fascinating character.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
She was a 14th century Spanish mystic, and she was around during the Spanish Inquisition and the Protestant Reformation, and she became a devout Catholic, even though the Catholic Church was under attack. Mm-hmm. She was a prolific writer. You know, she wrote numerous things and talked about this flight of the soul, that through prayer and meditation, we could reach altered states of rapture and ecstasy, and where we could actually leave our body. And there was several documented cases of levitation that she experienced, that where the nuns had to hold her down. And what's interesting is when you study some of the Indian fakers, you know, these mystics are allegedly, they are able to levitate. So it's not just in Christianity, but it's in Hinduism. And again, it may be in other religions too, but it's another aspect of Shepton that is just so fascinating.
And it seems like Dave Fellin took some mysteries to his grave.
Yeah, and we don't know what they are. You know, Fellin was very forthcoming in talking about his experiences there and what he saw. He spoke his mind. He didn't hold back. But he did say that there was some things that he experienced that he's never going to talk about, and he did take those to his grave. Mm-hmm. We don't know what they were. I personally don't think that they were, you know, had anything to do with cannibalism. But I don't know. It may be that maybe he saw things, or maybe he was told things. And maybe they were of such a spiritual, personal nature that it was just between him and perhaps Pope John the 23rd.
I don't know.
Yeah. But it's something that was profound.
Well, I will say that, and this comes from my experience as, you know, a paranormal researcher, whatever you want to call what I do. One of the questions I ask people, so I get called out on anything, any kind of call, whether it's Bigfoot, whatever, ghosts, UFOs. One of the things I ask these witnesses is, where is the buried treasure? And sometimes they will quite literally say, oh yeah, there's a story of buried treasure down the street. But by that I mean, where are people digging into the ground around here? Where are there legends of people digging in the ground? It occurs so frequently. These things happen around mines, around quarries, around places where there's legendary, you know, stories of people who have lost mines, lost mm-hmm. silver mines, this and that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So this applies to the Shepton, the Myth, Miracle, and Music book, and to your forthcoming book, where people dig into the ground, weird stuff happens. I can't tell you the connection, but, you know, I don't know if there's a correlation, but I know that it happens again and again. I ask these witnesses, and they come up with these stories. Oh yeah, there's a story of buried treasure down the street. There's a lost silver mine somewhere around here, you know, like that. Mm. So there's something to do with digging in the ground and paranormal stuff.
Yeah, incredible. And you know, we always talk about Gettysburg being so haunted with all the lost mm-hmm. souls there. And then you know, but you could say the same thing about the coal region. I mean, there's so many miners that died horrific deaths there.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
So you know, there, you know, very few people talk about that. You know, the apparitions, the ghosts in the coal region.
I highly recommend this book. It's Shepton: The Myth, Miracle, and Music by Maxim W. Furick. Where can people find it?
You could get it on Amazon.com. Or if you're looking for an autographed copy, you could contact me through my website, which is www.maximfurek.com. That's MAXIMFUREK.com.
And I'll put that in the show notes for people as well. And your new book is coming out when again? Very soon.
Yeah, it's coming out in this month. So
Wow.
We're waiting for it to be formatted and to be printed. So, and I'm excited. But it's called Coal Region Hoodoo, Paranormal Tales from Inside the Pit. It all takes place in Pennsylvania, and just some really exciting and weird stuff, including UFOs and Bigfoot and a lot of other things. I think it's going to go over big. I'm really excited about launching this and talking about it. So,
Well, you'll come back to Strange Familiars for that?
Absolutely, Tim. Yeah, I'd love to. And I really appreciate this opportunity. And, you know, I hope your listeners found this of interest and that they take a look at Shepton, the Shepton mythology. I think it's worth a look. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
I really like this book. There were points in this book where I was I guess because I'm claustrophobic a little bit. Yeah. I mean, who isn't? I guess everybody's a little bit
claustrophobic. Nobody wants to be down in a mine.
Yeah. But there are parts where I think Maxim really captured the emotion, like talking about their wives waiting on them. And it's a rough life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very rough life being a miner or the wife of a miner.
Or a coal miner's daughter.
I'm sure. Yeah. I really, really enjoyed this book. And speaking of books, what have we for our curiosity of the week here but a stack of books, Allison?
A stack of tiny books. These are from a series called The Little Leather Library. It is not...
S&M books?
No.
The Ballad of Reading Jail, Oscar Wilde. Vampire and Other Verses by Rudyard Kipling. Salome, also by Wilde. And A Dream of John Ball.
By William Morris.
By William Morris.
So it's like a lot of my favorite turn of the century.
Folks.
Who doesn't love Morris and Wilde and Kipling?
These are neat little books.
Wasn't Kipling like part of the OTO or something?
Yeah, I believe he was.
There you go, Octavian. Now you can buy that.
Or Golden Dawn.
Yeah, maybe it was the Golden Dawn.
They kind of blend together. Mm-hmm. Might have been Golden Dawn. So, when were these published?
Maybe at the latest 20s or 30s.
Yeah, we'll have to figure that out.
They have a really cool green leather covers, and they're tiny. They're like, oh, maybe 2x3. There's a whole series of them, and I just picked out some. I bought doubles of Salome so we could keep one, and I saved one of the Rubaiyat because we collect Rubaiyat stuff. So, But there are a lot of other classics, so I can get more if there's a certain...
Well, if people are looking for a certain
author or something, I could probably find it.
From that time,
yeah.
Not going to be Stephen King.
No, probably not.
No H.P. Lovecraft, Little Leather Libraries.
I don't think so.
More like classics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will put an image of one or more of these in the show notes, and if you click on it, it'll take you to our Etsy shop, where I think all of them will be listed.
You can choose which one you want.
I'll figure out how to do that.
Did it before. We can do it again.
Yes.
We have the technology.
Yes. While you're at Etsy, make sure to check out our other offerings, Strange Familiars t-shirts, original classic blue Awoken t-shirts along with Glow in the Dark. We got Strange Familiars stickers and patches there, artwork. You can buy originals of my artwork and prints, copies of my books. All of them are in stock right now. Allison has some antique photos up there and more. Our shop name is Lost Grave. If you type in Strange Familiars, you should see our stuff come up, though. Speaking of Etsy, Chad just added, I think, 3 knives with handles made from bone that we found at Devil's Hole. I believe it's Devil's Hole. He started to make a series of knives with bone handles from, you know, places we talk about on Strange Familiars. I think this first batch is from Devil's Hole, and that's in his Ruck Rabbit Outdoor Shop. He's on Etsy as well.
What kind of bones are they?
I think it's like a leg bone from a deer.
Mm.
I believe.
Because I imagine like a bird leg would be a tiny little knife.
Yeah.
I would like him to make a tiny little miniature little knife out of a bird bone.
I don't think that would be very sturdy at all.
I mean, yeah, I guess only if you needed to like shank a wren or something.
Bird bones being hollow.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I was over at Riverbend Comics on Sunday, Else. John and I...
You're cooking something up.
Oh, it's so much fun. We're working on a board game. It's a very Strange Familiars-y board game. I'm excited about this. I don't know how long it's going to take to come together. I will say this. We went from zero to playable game. We had so many ideas, and we were able to kind of hash them down and, you know, eliminate the things that wouldn't work. We went from a idea to a playable game pretty quickly, like in the course of a night, and we really kind of hammered it out. Of course, none of the artwork's done. You know, we're just basically, you know, doing what I could call a stick figure version of the game, using pawns basically as pieces and a die we pulled from another game and playing cards that he put stickers on that we can write on, you know, for the cards we need. But it was fun. It's going to be a good game, I think. I think people are going to like it. So, like I said, I don't know how long it takes to make a game. I'm going to have to do a lot of artwork for it and... You know, I'm still writing the Hermit's book and doing Strange Familiars and the Flower Path and everything else. But it's definitely something we're going to work towards getting out as soon as we can. Maybe I can get some other artists to help me with this. And if it goes well, it'll be expandable. So you can add other boards and other features to it. That's all I'm going to give away at this point. But that'll be coming at some point. You know, we've talked to a gaming company. It seems like they're interested. We'll run a Kickstarter on it. And as long as it gets funded, it's a go. And talking to the gaming company, a local gaming company, they said they don't think there's any reason it won't get funded. So in the future, there should be a super fun board game that's Strange Familiars adjacent, Strange Familiars related. So in the meantime, Riverbend Comics, riverbendcomics.com, all your comic needs. That Project Blue Book comic just dropped. And John makes sure to keep in a full selection of all the high strangeness type comic books if it's about Bigfoot or UFOs or something.
He has a good paranormal and horror collection
too. Yeah, he tries to get it in. Check out riverbendcomics.com. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back soon with more Strange Familiars. Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts, music, books, art, podcasts, and more. Intro and background music is by Stone Breath. If you want to hear more or purchase music, you can go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com. Strange Familiars is on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars. We're on Instagram, @strangefamiliars, and you can find us on the web at strangefamiliars.com.
Divine in purpose and meaning. foot and the stumps right in those lines.